Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, and WOOS 98.9 FM, Schenectady. Broadcasting live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, I'm Jules.
And I'm Sophia. The first segment today is more of Mark Dunley's coverage of the Capital District Solidarity Annual Labor Day Picnic.
Then, I sat down with Sanctuary intern Diani Drake to discuss film, music, and inspirations.
Later on, we will hear Willie Terry at the annual Labor Day picnic and celebration as well that took place on Monday in Colony.
Afterwards, Ann Perillo will speak to the executive director and four others about the Refugee Welcome Center in Albany.
Finally, we end our show with Elizabeth Press speaking to the organizers of Never Again Capital Region New York.
First off, let's do some headlines. Governor Cuomo signed a bill into law Wednesday that gives domestic violence victims more time to sue their abusers, extending the statute of limitations from 1 to 2 years. The legislation, which applies to civil lawsuits, provides survivors a better chance to hold perpetrators accountable.
The Cuomo administration has announced that it intends to keep fighting against the proposed Constitution gas pipeline that would terminate in Scoree County, even though the state's 2016 denial was overturned last month by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
The Times Union reports that legislation has been introduced in New York to ban 24-hour workdays and bolster working conditions for home health aides and other workers who provide care to the elderly, ill, and disabled at home. The legislation comes more than 6 months after New York's highest court upheld a State Department of Labor regulation that allows home health care workers to get paid for only 13 hours of a 24-hour shift, so long as they are afforded an 8-hour sleep break and 3 hours of meal breaks. Opponents argue the bill will dramatically increase healthcare costs or reduce home healthcare services.
The Troy Record reports that the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall Corporation and the Empire State Youth Orchestra have created a nonprofit organization, Alliance for Music Performance in Troy, that will provide exciting new musical arts opportunities for the region. AMPT was developed to use the vacant floors of the Troy Savings Bank building, which was recently acquired by the Troy Music Hall Corporation.
The contribution rate to the state and local government pension system will remain at 14.6% for most workers, though there will be a small increase in rates for the police and fire retirement system. State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli is also dropping the long-term assumed rate of return on investments from 7% to 6.8%, one of the lowest in the country for state public pension plans. DiNapoli continues to invest more than $11 billion in fossil fuels companies, despite their low rate of return. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. In our first segment, we hear part three of Mark Dunley's coverage of the Capital District Solidarity Annual Labor Day Picnic. He talks with political activist Pete Looker about climate, bus, transportation, and sustainability. He also talks with Mabel Leon on Cuban solidarity and Grannies for Peace.
So we're talking with Pete Looker, who's here with Terry Robin, also hangs out with groups like Capital District PAWS. I think I've seen him at an Extinction Rebellion meeting, and I've seen him probably a couple 100 protests in recent years. So, Pete, go green, declare peace. What's that message, particularly here on Labor Day at the Solidarity Picnic?
Well, if we declare peace, we could save a lot of energy and save a lot of pollution. We live across from an old polluted Navy yard that still hasn't been cleaned up 50 years later. So it's a combination of stop killing people and start being nice to the planet.
I saw you at a protest up in, I guess, around Glens Falls, around immigration. I wasn't sure if you got arrested or not, but what was the protest about, and what did you do?
Well, we wanted to talk to...
Well, with Bill McKibben, I believe, was there too.
Yeah, Bill ended up showing up, and I was very glad that he did, because he brought in the fact that if you look at it, most of the immigrants in the world, the problems come from climate change, climate disaster, and or our military, political, throwing in supporting dictators and throwing out elected leaders. So he brought that issue to light there. But we were basically wanted to talk to the representative and talk to her about not the end of ICE, but ICE and what they were doing with the kids and how unfair they were treating people that are coming across the borders that we have established when we took over the land from other people.
And so how has the congresswoman been on this particular issue?
Kind of quiet, as a typical congressperson is. Not much backbone.
Mm-hmm. Now, on a technical work issue, since I have you here, winter's starting to show its tentacles. It's getting a little colder. You know, you're a chimney sweep. If you've got a homeowner out there, what should they be thinking about with the upcoming winter in terms of getting prepared for it? And like, particularly like a wood stove or something, or otherwise just getting ready in terms of energy?
Oh, taking the... one of the little things is to take the screens off of the windows so that we can get all that free solar energy coming through our windows. The screens will block 20-30% of that free energy. Insulating, tighten things up, and yeah, you want to, it depends on how you use your chimney, but you want to check the chimney out. But I make money off of that, so I want to add that to it. But I'm doing less than I used to do 40 years ago.
So I see a lot of climate rallies in the Capital District. You know, what do we need to get happen at this point to give us a chance to survive in climate change?
Well, I think we need to just transition. I like the image that Greta talks about in terms of maybe 10% every year, use 10% less every year. I mean, it can be your food, it can be your traveling, it can be whatever. And if we all kind of make an energy plan and look at how much we're using, just like if you were doing with your house, like how much energy am I using? And then how can I cut it back? And it's not, it wouldn't be that difficult. As Bill McKibben pointed out, I think in New Yorker just the other day, that unlike World War I, World War II, where we had to deal with fascism, we sent people off to kill people, and other people were killing those people that we sent off to kill people, this isn't going to involve killing people. We just have to transition over to a sustainable, simple, solar and wind-powered economy, as Edison was pointing out to Ford back in the 30s. It's fairly simple.
So we've been talking to Pete Luker. We have about a minute left. One that I also see you doing in the Capital District is riding your bicycle everywhere, including, I believe, putting it on front of the CTA buses. So in the last minute, what can the Capital District do both to improve access for bicycling, but also the bus system?
Well, if you're conservative and cheap and lazy like me, you could ride your bike down to the bus. And then if you're old like me, instead of spending $4 a day, you could spend $2 a day and ride anywhere you want to do. The big blue limo picks you up and your chauffeur takes you from here to there and everything else. So it's a way of saving money, because most people don't realize that gas is a small percentage of the cost when they're driving. They're wearing out their car. 58 cents a mile now that the government allots for that, and 15 cents is gas, the rest of it's wear and tear. So be cheap and lazy, and use share a ride, walk down, bike down, plan a ride. You know, it's not I'm no genius, and it's not brain surgery.
So this has been Pete Luker with Terry Robin and Capital District Quiz. So we catch up with Mabel Leon at the annual Labor Solidarity Picnic here in the Capital District. One of the things I know Mabel has done a lot over the years is solidarity for in Cuba. Cuba doesn't seem to be on the friend list for our present federal administration. what are some of the challenges that you see with Cuba and the United States at the moment?
Well, first of all, there is still an embargo. For instance, I had a friend in my neighborhood traveling to Cuba, and she wanted to know how she could use credit. You can't use credit. There is a total embargo. The embargo is in effect. Now, it was in effect under Obama also. So there, I mean, we have had such a failed policy toward Cuba year after year. And what is it based on? We are afraid of Cuba. We are afraid of a system that's different than ours. I think that's the only conclusion you can come to. And all I can say when you talk about Cuba, why did I work with Cuba? Free health care and more doctors located on every corner, a system of health care, can you believe that? Not a system that serves the insurance companies, not a system set up for profit, a system that's set up with neighborhood doctors that feed into neighborhood clinics that then feed into specialty hospitals. There is a whole system of giving services and free education. Now, talk to anybody who's got a kid going to college right now, and they won't be able to believe it. Free education through college. But that doesn't mean you get to go because daddy has a lot of money. You get to go to college if your grades qualify you for college. So, I mean, there are just so many things that I respect, and this is a poor third world country. I always say, we need Cuba, first of all, as a symbol of a country that has stood up to the beast. We need Cuba because of the model for how it serves its citizens. Does that mean Cuba's perfect? Cuba has all kinds of problems. And anybody you talk to in Cuba will tell you all about it. They're the most verbal people, and they're not afraid to tell you what they think. So there you go. We have a lot of work to turn that around. And it, obviously, it is not likely to happen under Trump with Bolton or Pompeo. I mean...
Okay, so Mabel, one of the other groups I see you hanging out with on occasion is Grannies for Peace. What are some of the critical pieces you see us needing to address in the next year or so?
With Grannies for, well, first of all, let me just say that, you know, a lot of people snicker and laugh when you say Grannies for Peace, and I just turn around and tell them, grannies are powerful. You know why? They're motivated by love. And if you get in touch with what you want for your grandchildren, it's not very far distant to think that every grandmother wants the same thing that you want for your grandchildren. So that leads you to all kind of issues. And of course, one of the biggest ones is endless war. We are engaged in conflict all over this nation. And a good example is Afghanistan. You tell me, how many years have we been in Afghanistan? 17, 18?
I was going to say 17, but it could certainly be 19.
The
graveyards of civilizations, they call it, or graveyards of war. No one beats them.
Well, no one defeats Afghanistan, but the pain that we have caused in Afghanistan, and we climb up on this little pedestal and say, oh, what we have done for the women, what we have done for the women. The United Nations lists Afghanistan as one of the most dire places for women to have babies, one of the most dire places for children to grow up. And the education that has happened for children or for women has been very sparse, and it's never in the countryside. We have done nothing but bomb, use drones. We have brought more misery to Afghanistan.
And that was Mabel Leon at the annual Solidarity Labor Pick.
That was part three of Mark Dunley's coverage of the Capital District Solidarity Annual Labor Day Picnic.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. In our next segment, H. Bosch Jr. sat down with Sanctuary intern Deonnie Drake and discussed film, music, and her inspirations and role models.
Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr. with another Triple E's segment, Education Empowerment Entrepreneurship. Today's guest is our very own Deani Drake, a 21-year-old intern at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And I am blessed and honored to have the opportunity to interview her. So let's dig right in. What inspired you to work at the Sanctuary?
So I had a professor at UAlbany. Her name was Julie Casper Roth, and I was very interested in documentary studies, and she was like, go to the Sanctuary. Like, they have so many resources and you learn so much there. So I thought, wow, like, this would be a perfect opportunity for me to, like, kind of get my foot in the door, because I've only been doing just like a documentary and like using my camera at that time for a few months. So when I started, I was just a volunteer and I was working on the 4-camera shoots and I was just seeing how everything is. And then I inquired with Branda, and I was just like, wow, like, you guys have an internship. I looked it up online, and she was like, well, if you apply for it, then you'll most likely get it because you've already been working with the Sanctuary. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that it would be like a whole nother experience instead of working in retail over the summer, mm-hmm. to actually get my foot in the door in a career path that I wanted, like, that I really am looking forward to, like, doing.
Oh, great. So how do Black creations inspire your work?
So there are definitely, like, Ava DuVernay and her 4-part series about the Central Park Five, and just like those other creatives like Spike Lee. Like, I really love his work. So I think, and just like local creatives, there's people in my hometown in Rockland County that just do so much on a local scale. So when I see all of their work, it's just, it takes me to a place like, wow, I can actually do this because it's being done in a local setting, like a local setting and a grander scale. So as for myself, I play violin. I've been into music since I was about 9. And then I got into filmmaking when I was about 19, 20. So seeing myself as a Black creative, seeing other Black creatives do what they're doing, inspires just me to do so much. And yeah, like, just seeing them is really inspiring.
Well, I'll share something about the Central Park Five documentary. Yusuf Salam, who's one of the Central Park Five, we've shared the same stage several times. We spoke at events, and I am so happy that they're now getting their proper due, and that case is really having some, they're beginning to throw some shine on that horrific experience that they all went through, and I'm so happy for them. But moving back to you, what got you into filmmaking, and did you lead to this pathway? Because there's so many other things that you could have got into. So what got you into filmmaking?
That's true. And it seemed as if when I was first starting off, I was falling out of a music career because I was a violinist.
Me and you both.
So, yeah.
You didn't know you were going to laugh on this interview.
So, yeah, like, I was falling out of a music career, and I thought that, oh man, my life is over. Like, I didn't know what to do, because when I was auditioning for these music, like, conservatories, I just wasn't getting into them. And there was a certain style that they were looking for. So when I got into filmmaking, I found friends at Purchase College who were filmmakers, and they were doing great work. And I thought, like, I have so many ideas that don't even come to the forefront of my mind because I'm so consumed with my music career, not even expanding my mind to think, oh, I can do so many other things. So when I saw them do their work, and I would go to their screenings and I would help them with their, like, film sets, I'd like, wow, like, this is something I can do myself. And leading to me meeting Julie Casper Roth and then going to the Sanctuary, it's like all of these things seem to be aligning themselves. Like, by the grace of God, like, all of these things are kind of falling into place, and this is what I should be doing. And it's not like I'm not going to be a musician, but I think this is where I'm more headed towards, because more opportunities have come my way this way.
Okay. And let me just interject something. This is part one of a 2-part segment. There are some fascinating another fascinating part of this young lady's life that we're going to talk about, her family and her family roots and her great grandmom. I mean, it's going to be a story that you're going to really, really want to hear. But let's close out on this one. Who inspires you the most?
Well, speaking of family, I have to say my mom. Like, my mom is so inspirational. She has three kids, and she is working, and she's being successful in what she's doing. And, like, she raised us properly, you know? And we got our education. So I think, like, all the things that she's doing in her career and all the things that she's, like, have raised us, like, with our morals and, like, kind of instilling these things that are, like, morality and, like, humanity, I think she's my biggest inspiration. Not to be corny or anything, but, you know, like, my mom is my biggest inspiration.
I think that's not corny at all. Apples don't fall far from the tree. And looks like she, first and foremost, has raised some truly successful human beings. And that's where it starts, and that's where it ends, at being a successful human being. Once you become that, everything else follows, and I think you did a great job at that. But let's close out with some questions that I always like to ask young and inspiring artists. What's your favorite book you read?
My favorite book? The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois.
Okay.
A really good one. I'm still reading it, but it's giving us a perspective of how black thought was in the early 1900s, and just like how we have these like things that are instilled in us from like capitalism and like society, and how we seem to fall into patterns sometimes, but we can break ourselves out of these patterns through education, through like voting, because voting is big, and to like elect officials that really care about us, you know. And I'm not too far into the book, but I've really enjoyed reading it because I'm getting that perspective from a black scholar from the early 1900s, you know? So.
Great, great. You got to pass that on to me when you're done.
Yeah.
My next question is your favorite TV show growing up as a little girl?
My favorite TV show? That's a hard one because I had so many.
So give me your first three.
My first three. Malcolm in the Middle was really good. Growing up, so not right now.
All right, so give me something right now.
Yeah, there's a show called Dear White People that's on Netflix, and that's really, really, really good. I recommend that everyone watch it. And favorite TV show, I'd have to say Bernie Mac Show.
Great choice.
Yeah.
All right, the teacher who inspired you the most and what grade?
Name was Miss Hirschman, and she was in the second grade because she would incorporate fun and like creativity and like being relaxed into our curriculum, where there's so many like structures for like taking this test, and like she would bring in cookies while you take tests, and then she would have like these like parties. And I remember her sugar cookies were just so good as a kid, and I feel like that was like a very impactful childhood memory, because it's like none of my teachers would make cookies for their children and like for their students and then like give them out and then have them have fun and then like instill that same discipline, but at the same time not make it such a regimented, structured environment where we are not encouraged to be independent thinkers. Mm-hmm. So I really shout out to Miss Hirschman.
That's what I was going to say. Shout out to Miss Hirschman. Okay, so we'll end this with this will be my last question. Deani, you're so young and talented, and I can see that there's big, big things ahead of you for your future. So what would you tell this little girl looking at you and saying, wow, I really like what you are doing and what you're becoming? What words of empowerment would you give her?
I would give this girl just never stop looking and never stop searching for what you want to do, just because it seems as if you may be stuck in one thing. And you have to do that thing forever. And that's definitely not true. You can explore different things around you. So I think just understanding that you're limitless. And you're just like an independent thinker. You don't have to go and follow a line. You can be the leader of that line. You can aspire to do so many things. And just be a free thinker. You're not stuck to a stigma or a stereotype or a way of living because of any factor, like your background or your ethnicity or your financial income. You can do so many things with so little, even. So I think that's what I would tell them.
I totally agree. My mom used to always say, not to have is no reason not to get. She was born and raised in the birthplace, the cradle of civil rights, Alabama, which we know we both have a connection.
Yeah.
And I will say that that will be, or I'll say this before I end. This is part one of a two-part segment. And the next segment, we're going to really dig into Deani's family, her history, and how her grandmom and her great-grandmom have influenced her decisions as well as her family's legacy. So I just want to say I thank you for what you're doing. I thank you for what you're going to do. And I thank you for what you will continue to do. You are a true, true blessing and an inspiration to every little Black girl that looks up and say, I can be something. So thank you so much.
Thank you, thank you so much, Bosch.
I appreciate you. Okay, so until next time, folks, it's about the triple E's: education, empowerment, entrepreneurship. And remember this, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe.
That was our former media intern, Deani Drake. Deani, if you're listening, we miss you very much.
For those just tuning in, I'm Sophia.
And I'm Jules. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in at 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. This next segment is from the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry, who also attended the annual Labor Day picnic and celebration on Monday, September 2nd in Cook Park and Colony. The Labor Day picnic and celebration was sponsored by the Solidarity Committee of the Capital District. You will hear his interview with Ben Vanderwerken, treasurer of the Democratic Socialists of America, on his views of Labor Day 2019.
Willie Terry, you're a roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And I'm here at the Labor Day picnic in the village of the Colony Cook Park Pavilion. I have right now one of the participants here. His name is Ben Van... How you pronounce it?
Vanderwerken.
Vanderwerken.
It's Dutch for of the working.
Right.
Pretty proud of.
And he's in the DSA, which stands for?
Democratic Socialists of America.
And you're the treasurer.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the most important positions.
I have a spreadsheet, and I keep it updated.
Oh, okay. All right. So what is the DSA?
So the DSA is a... I believe that we call ourselves an activist organization. We're not a political party, but we are basically a group of communally minded like activists who carry forth the ideology of democratic socialism, which is the idea that we can have a just society where workers control their workplaces and communities control their cities, their counties, their towns, and that we are able to organize ourselves in a just way and answer the crises of the 21st century, find communal answers to climate change, wealth inequality, the numerous just crises. I mean, integration of immigrants, integration of people who are climate refugees, right? We need to have answers to this that are decided democratically, that aren't decided by people who inherited great positions of wealth or were elected through just were appointed by, you know, like a minority of the population, right? I mean, like the current president, the last, like, what, four of the five Republican presidents have been elected with a minority of the population. And so what we are is we are trying to just generate a spirit of change, I would say.
Is that in line with Bernie Sanders? He considered it would be a DSA?
Yeah, so the DSA has endorsed Bernie Sanders, and I personally believe he would be the best choice for president because he is not only the most, like, has remained consistent on these issues for the last 30 years, has been a voice for like progressive politics, radical politics, but also is willing to just take people's energy and actually use it. You know, like we've had presidents in the past promise, make promises in their campaign, but Bernie Sanders is out there writing bills, fundamentally changing the way the American economy will work. Where, like, instead of paying for insurance, mandatory insurance that then can be revoked from you when you actually need it, you will just, like, it will just be given to you, and it'll be paid communally from all of us, right? Like, that's, like, that's the ideal to me.
Right. Well, Trump called Obama a socialist. Was Obama a socialist?
I don't believe he was.
Oh, okay. Well, you heard that from the Democratic Socialist of America. Obama wasn't a socialist. Let me just ask you a couple of questions, too. Now, let's say if you had to grade the labor movement, this Labor Day, you know, this Labor Day, try to do this every Labor Day. Let's say, like in school, from an A to an F, what grade would you give it and why?
You know, the fact that this is even happening to me, the fact that we can gather and celebrate labor, like, is itself, like, an A already. I mean, would there, like, unions actually, you know, we have, like, what, 5%, 6% union participation in an American economy. It is a minority. But also, I think that people are realizing that we need that kind of workplace protection. We need to, I think that we can gather on this Labor Day shows that the flame of workplace solidarity is still alive, that people still see the need to come together and protect their own interests and their coworkers' interests as fellows. Obviously, I mean, if we could turn that 5% to a, you know, a 50% or a 100%, like, that's the future I want to see, but, you know, it has to start somewhere.
Okay. So what do you think, let's say, the labor movement, what are the key issues in the labor movement? Because I'm asking the labor question because the DSA, I take it that you deal with union and organized labor.
I mean, wages are obviously, like, a big one, right? I mean, we have our minimum wage is a lot higher than the rest of the country in New York State. It's still below a living wage. But even more than that, there's mandatory overtime or people getting their having their hours cut for no reason. You know, like when you are a worker by yourself, you have no control over what your boss can do to you, right? You are in a constant state of appeasement. And so every kind of ill, you know, like being scheduled on holidays, even though you asked for them off, right? Being scheduled, not enough hours to, like, you know, pay your rent, or being scheduled too many hours to, like, take care of your kids and have to pay for a daycare. Like, it can come from any direction. And so what we see is we want to empower workers to, like, form unions, form bonds of solidarity. Then they can say, no, this is unjust. You know, I can't, like, this, you promised me this and then you took it away, and we're not going to accept that. And so that's what we, I think we see as, we don't want to end up in a world where the minimum wage goes up to $15 an hour and then but people are still left isolated from each other. We, like, the wages are part of being able to live a just and upright life.
Right. Okay. Now, there's an election coming up this year and a major election coming up next year. Now, the question I want to ask you is, do you feel that the labor movement should begin to build their own party, or should they continue to their relationship with the Democratic Republican Party?
That's a difficult question because the American political system is so, you know, I mean, it's you start a third party, you weaken the people that would be closest to you because your enemies will remain, you know, as one, and we can't coalition, right? The way when we have an election, you can't coalition. You have to run, as one, or else your vote will be split. But that said, though, I do think that I in my personal case in Schenectady, I was canvassing for Teresa McCallman. She was the first African American woman to ever run for mayor of Schenectady, and it was the first time that the Schenectady mayoral race for the Democrats had ever had a primary in the last like 100 years. And what we see there is there's this like this status quo, especially within the Democratic Party, that is ripe for disruption. She came within, I think, 5% of the vote for the primary, running like as a first-time contestant. She did end up losing to the incumbent, but it was still a very inspiring race for me to see.
I don't think that
taking on like an independent political party would at best be like regionally isolated. Like you wouldn't be able to fracture. If you like came up like the Green Party, it might win in California, but how do you affect the national level, right? Well, there is a Green Party, so maybe I'm talking.
Well, a lot of people say that the Democrat and Republican Party are, well, although there may be some slight differences, that they're both the same. They're both staunch defender of the capitalist system that you got on your shirt.
We're in the primary cycle right now of the Democratic presidential candidates. And if you look at, like, to be honest, if you look at the main, I'm going to call them centrist candidates, like the kind of capital part of the coalition, it's like people like Joe Biden, Pete Buttigieg, Michael Bennett, John Hickenlooper, John Delaney. And I think, in my opinion, these are all extremely weak candidates who cannot get, who cannot, like, energize their base, who cannot get popular support. And I think what this shows is that in the Democratic coalition right now, the activists, the labor, the radical part, the community base, not the part that has the money, but the part that has the people, is strong and getting stronger. And I think that is where the potential to really crack into national politics lies, is, like, seeing all of these kind of milquetoast fogies get washed away in a big tide of like communal energy.
Okay, so there you have it. Ben Vanderwerker from the Democratic Socialists of America.
Thank you,
Ben.
No problem.
Thank you, Willie Terry, for that interview with Ben Vanderwerken, treasurer of the Democratic Socialists of America.
Next up, we have Schenectady Today host Ann Perillo speaking with Tim Doherty, the executive director, Sue St. Pierre, the ESL coordinator, along with Naz Farconda and Ogjwe about the Refugee Welcome Center in Albany that brings together local vacant houses with essentially globally homeless people.
We're going to take our first guest right now, and we have four lovely people here today. We have Tim Doherty, and he is the director of the Refugee Welcome Center. They're located over in Albany. And Sue St. Pierre, you're right behind me. And she is the ESL person there who does the language, language for English as a second language. And then we have two lovely kids here. And we have a name, I'm sorry.
Aung Sue.
Okay, this is Sue.
Aung Sue.
Aung Sue, and he's from Burma? Burma, Myanmar, I guess they call that now,
yep.
Right? Burma. And then behind her, we have Farouk?
No, it's Farconda.
Okay, who is it? Farconda.
Yeah.
Oh, good. So let's talk about the Refugee Center. Oh, and then our next guest just came in. Thank you so much. And he is Nazir, right? Nazir?
Nazir Alami.
Tell us about the Refugee Center.
The center comes about, we've had programming now for just a year.
So you're relatively new.
The center itself as an addendum to the project is new. We were working with helping to provide some affordable housing in this block area to folks who are struggling to find affordable housing.
Right, and it's difficult. It's very difficult.
Yeah, we had a lot of vacancies, so we just said, well, how about if we put empty houses together with basically globally homeless people and try to put some neighbors back
right
in the neighborhood.
Right, mm-hmm. And how successful do you feel you're being?
It's a heck of an adventure. The center came about because we said, how are we going to keep them here? You know, so we said we need to give more services and provide ways for volunteers to match up with people to help out, reading, mail, just about everything. But then we found the women, Sue has talked to the English classes, but
yeah,
you know, kids programming. We have a space, basically, that can become a lot of different things. And so that's the center, but the corporation is a bigger kind of a
bigger mission.
Neighborhood building project.
Yeah, and of course, you know, every person that comes to this country bring something with them. So whether culture or whether talent, whatever it is, and that's what we have to look at. Yeah. So one of the biggest obstacles I would imagine is language, because I have been in other countries where I don't speak the language and there's no giveaways. If you've been to China, there's no giveaways. You can't tell by the sign what it means or anything. How do they accomplish
that? We have a few levels of English classes, and mostly what we have are pre-literate, mostly women, and we bring in articles from the kitchen, or, you know, it's called Realia in the ESL world, and we show a lot of images on a computer so that they can see what we're trying to teach. What it gets really difficult is when you're trying to teach a concept.
Emotion or something.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, very, very hard. But it's amazing to me, in, say, 6 months, we would have, you know, a group of women come in who knew know nothing. They've never held a pencil before. They never went to a school in their country that they're from. And we progress along with them, and then someone new comes in to be a student. Then we realize how much these women really have learned.
They have learned.
It's amazing. And
because they have to be able to function in our world. And I must say this, my grandmother was Italian. She came to this country and never learned a word of English in all the time she lived here. She stayed in her home, her husband worked, but she never learned any. And I never communicated with her, which is really sad. So what you're doing is amazing.
Well, we're really trying to help these women acclimate and be able to talk to their children's teachers at school.
And you can't if you don't.
No. No.
So my grandmother probably never spoke to the teachers because she didn't work, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right, yeah.
So it's important, and I love the idea about the concepts, because I remember my mother sometimes saying, well, there's no word in English to translate that. Do you find that same thing, that they don't, their words are mean different, you know?
No, actually, they know so little, we're not even to that point.
Oh, we're not even at that point yet. Okay, good. So let's go to your next guest there, and let me tell us something about you.
Okay, so I'm 13 years old. I go to middle school, and...
And you speak English very well.
Thank you. Some people say I have accents, but yeah.
Be happy with your accent.
Yeah. Yeah, and I play soccer, and I do chess.
And I understand you're a chess. Do you play chess too?
Yes, I play chess.
You're doing pretty well in chess, I understand.
Yeah, thank you. I've been playing it for 4 years, I think.
Yeah.
Or more. Yeah.
Okay, and what school do you go to?
I go to Myers Middle School.
Okay, good. And are you, how long have you been in this country?
I think about three and a half years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what country did you come from?
I came from Turkey, but I'm not from there.
From where?
I came from Turkey, but I'm not
Turkey?
From there. Yeah.
Turkey? Oh, okay, good. Yeah.
I'm from Iran, but.
Okay. They move around.
Yes.
Yeah, I understood.
Move around a lot, yeah.
When we do the ancestry.com, we find out just how far people have moved around. Mm-hmm. And let's go over to you and just tell us quickly about yourself.
Yeah, my name is Nazar Lamin. I'm vice president of Sudanese American Soccer Federation.
So you like soccer?
Yeah, we do. And we have this big event been around almost 20 years. And we go different state every year. And this year we'll be in Albany. And we have about 12 states. And we're expecting more than 2,000 people. They already been booked about more than 300 room in the capital area. And that event include the culture and the history of United States and Sudan. And we're trying to teach our kids and our youth about the two culture, and they can involve in the community and the social in United States, and it's been a very successful event.
And that's really what we're trying to do, is to show cultures and things. And how about our Ang?
Let's wait.
He's mic'd. He's mic'd. Quickly, yeah.
My name is Ang Sowe, and I like to play soccer. I usually hang out around with my friend every single time. Sometimes I stay home and help my mom translate. And the thing I do is play soccer with my uncle, and I go to Skylar Achiever.
Skylar Achievement?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I like to ride, I like to go to the park and hang out with my new friends that live near the park. And I usually do is just play around. Sometimes I stay home and sleep.
Yeah. You're just like any other kid, right? Wonderful. Well, welcome to our country, and I hope that you find have lots of fun. I love what you're doing, and how do people support you? Can they go to your website?
The website has a donation button. It can contact the email if anyone's interested in coming around and assisting or working to build some programming.
Good. So just you can use anything. Your volunteers, and you can use money.
Yeah.
Give them some support. They're doing some really good work, and look at these great people that they brought with us. And thank you all for coming today.
To learn more about the Refugee Welcome Center, go to www.rwcwesthill.com.
Finally, in our last segment, we hear Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Elizabeth Press talking to the organizers of Never Again Capital Region New York about Jews organizing against ICE.
Today I'm joined by Miriam Axelut and Brianna Becker from the local Never Again Organizing Committee. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
Thank you. Miriam, could you start off by just telling us what is Never Again?
Sure. So earlier this summer in New Jersey, there were a group of Jews who got together and realized that they felt very strongly that they needed to stand up against what was happening to our immigrant neighbors and the persecution from ICE. And they got together and blocked a detention center in Elizabeth, New Jersey, calling themselves the Never Again group, echoing the, you know, we are taught to make sure that the Holocaust never happens again. And that involves stopping it before it gets there. And from that, just it really struck a chord with Jews all across the country. And it snowballed very fast as actions started popping up all over the country.
I've read about the action in Texas and how some people face up to 6 months in jail, but you were actually at the action in Washington, D.C. Can you tell us a little bit about that action?
I was there, yes. And in that action, we actually shut down the ICE headquarters for an entire afternoon, which felt appropriate. And in very symbolic, we had over 80 people risking arrest and a small handful who were arrested inside the building. And it was with a whole bunch more people supporting us in the streets, and it was an incredibly powerful action.
Brianna, could you just take us through and tell us sort of the connection of why Never Again, as Jews organizing, why this is an important issue to take on now?
Definitely. So, I mean, I sort of speak from my own experience, but I think most American Jews connect to the story in some way. So I'm the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors. My grandparents were in a concentration camp. And so Never Again I was raised to be super vigilant, both for ourselves, but for everyone, right? That Never Again isn't specifically about Jews. It's about Never Again, this kind of tragedy, this kind of horror. Never Again, not specifically the capital H Holocaust, though that too, but Never Again genocide for anyone or this kind of treatment. And so seeing what was happening at the border and through this country, both what's happening in whether you want to call them detention camps or concentration camps, right, where they're keeping folks at the border and throughout the country, but also the way that we're now creating a culture where people are telling on their neighbors, right, turning in people because they're having disputes that have nothing to do with immigration. It doesn't look like 1943 or whatever, right? It doesn't look like Auschwitz, but it does look like the 1930s in Germany. And it looks like what we've been looking like. I've been watching my whole life like a canary in a coal mine for this kind of possibility, and now it's happening in my country, and it's not happening to me, right? I'm a born citizen. My mother was naturalized, but, like, it's happening to the most vulnerable people in our community, much like the Jews were hyper-vulnerable in 1930s Europe.
Thank you for making that connection for us. Here in the Capital Region, Never Again, Capital Region New York is organizing an action this weekend.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about what is happening on September 8th?
Absolutely. So we're going to be gathering in Troy. And the reason that we're selected Troy is that the Rensselaer County government is in this region and across, in fact, across the state, some of the most active in being cooperative with ICE and speaking out and creating an atmosphere, a threatening atmosphere toward their immigrant residents. The Rensselaer County Sheriff is the only sheriff in New York State to participate in the ICE cooperation agreement through the 287G program. And so we wanted to come together and say, immigrants in Troy are our neighbors, and this is a place where we need to stand up and say, this is part of this larger problem, and we need to fix this part here while we're also calling for closing the camps and ending family separation and things like that. So we're going to gather at 2 p.m. in Terrace Shevchenko Park, which is at the intersections of 3rd and 4th Street. And then we're going to have a march, and we're going to have an action, and there will be people who will be risking arrest because they consider this so important that they really need to stand up and put their bodies on the line in that way. And everybody is welcome. We certainly encourage Jews to come out, but allies of all kinds who want to come out and take a stand on this are very welcome to join us.
Speaking of that, not only in this action with inviting people from different backgrounds to join in, the Jews are not the only religious affiliation organizing against ICE and immigration policy in the states at this time. Can you talk about your connection and sort of the power of the movement of different faiths organizing in this way?
So for me, like, this is heartening, right, that this is not something that only Jews who have sort of an immediate connection to this kind of history care about. I was reading the news, I think, this morning, and recently we just saw a pretty significant action from Catholics, both clergy and lay people. And I think in some ways it speaks to B'Tselem Elohim, the idea of being created in the image of God is specifically like the Jewish way of describing that. But that is something I think that is shared across many religious traditions, and that a similar concept, right, that like we all have value as human beings is a shared secular value that many of us have. And so, right, that standing up together, because Jews are a really small minority in the United States. We make up less than 2% of the population. Data says that you need 3.5% of the population on the streets to reach critical mass for change, which means we need somebody else because we're not going to get 100% of our population to the streets. And this matters to everyone, right? This is not impacting. Jews are actually relatively unimpacted on an individual level. And so I'm hoping, right, that we will continue to see these kinds of actions from Catholic communities and that we will start to see this from the Protestant and the evangelical community, who are perhaps the least vulnerable religious communities in our nation, right? And so I'm hoping that other folks will choose to step up and answer this call as well.
When you see what's happening with immigration policy in this country, what drives you to do these symbolic actions?
Well, I mean, at the most basic level, I'm a parent. Right. And so I think for a lot of people, it hit home when we started to see the family separation. We see children dying alone without their families or just traumatized for life because of being pulled away. And it's not that we only need to take care of the children. We need to take care of everybody who's coming in fleeing violence. But I think a lot of people for a lot of people, it's that the children that have motivated us to act, even though it's difficult to get out there. And I think that certainly pushed me over the edge.
If people are hearing for the first time about Never Again and this organizing that's taking place for September 8th at 2 p.m., how could our audience or people in our community get involved?
Great. So if you go to Facebook, Never Again Capital Region NY, you can find us there. You can find us on Twitter at Never Again CRNY. And there, if you fill out our Google form or indicate that you're coming, you'll get more information about how to get involved.
I know you mentioned a direct action. Can people also tap into that? Or
yes.
Great. And is there anything else you would like to add about the event on Sunday or anything else going on with Never Again in the Capital Region?
I think I'd add, if you're interested in being involved with the direct action, please get on the Facebook page and fill out the Google form now, because you'll want to be in touch with us ahead of time.
Indeed. And I just want to say that I'm extremely heartened by the kind of response that we've had to this. When we started organizing, we didn't know what sort of response we would get in the Capital Region, and it's been overwhelming. People have wanted this so badly. They've really wanted a way to step out and show how they feel about what's going on.
And are some of the major Jewish organizing groups part of Never Again, like Jewish Voices for Peace or any of these groups? Or
there are people from those organizations participating. Never Again is specifically across the country an organization of individuals rather than institutions, but certainly people from those organizations are participating, as well as a number of synagogues.
Never Again Action is sort of chosen to not affiliate with anything else so that this is focused on the particular issue rather than becoming sort of a broad-based question what else we're addressing.
Right. We're uniting Jews from all different walks of life. We have folks from synagogues, Reform, Conservative, even Orthodox participating.
And across various kinds of political spectrums, too. Exactly. I mean, we're obviously missing some folks, but like it's meant to be as inclusive an umbrella as possible so we can address this particular issue.
Great. Thank you. So once again, that's Sunday, September 8th at 2 p.m. in Troy, New York. And check out Never Again Capital Region New York.
NY.
For the details on that. And thank you very much, Miriam Axelute and Brianna Becker, for joining me here on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
That was Elizabeth Press interviewing Miriam Axelute and Brianna Becker from the local Never Again Organizing Committee. If you want to support the action, you can find them at www.gofundme.com/f/never-again-capital-region. That concludes our show for tonight. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Jules.
And I'm Sophia. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith.
Hey.
Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.